vegetables. Mirjan can no longer buy construction paper for her children's projects at school. Many mornings she doesn't have money for the school's midday meal. Those days she keeps the children home. Sometimes they are absent from school 3 days in a row. Each of her three children owns one pair of shoes, purchased on a layaway plan. She owes the grocery store up the block so much money it cuts off her line of credit. She worries that her children are eating too much of the food her sister brings over for Enrique's grandmother. When Mirjan walks her children down the block, they beg her to buy them a soda or an ice cream cone. She cannot. "I can't stand this situation anymore," Mirjan tells Belki. She wants to go to the United States. She'll go just long enough to save money to fix up her mother's house and add on a room for her own beauty parlor. She'll go for a few years and return before her children miss her much. They won't feel abandoned. Lourdes is alarmed when she hears that Mirjan wants to set out for the north on her own. "No way," Lourdes tells her. Lourdes's boyfriend now pays the rent, and Lourdes has recently landed a better-paying factory job. Somehow Lourdes and her boyfriend will come up with the money for a smuggler. One morning, 3 years after Enrique left Honduras, Mirjan sits her three children down to say goodbye. "I'm going to the States. You will stay with your grandma." She tells them she is going to work and send them money, clothes, and toys. She cries. So does her oldest, 9-year-old Michelle. Junior, 7, asks when she is coming back. She cannot say. "But are you coming back?" he presses. "Yes." Mirjan steps off the same porch Lourdes left from 14 years before. Her youngest child is 2.5 years old. She still breastfeeds. The girl, used to sleeping with her mother, cries for Mirjan that night. Belki takes her into her bed. For the first time, Belki understands her own mother's choice to leave her as a young child. She has watched Mirjan's plight. She has seen her grapple with the gut-wrenching decision to leave. She agrees with Mirjan's decision. Meanwhile, Maria Isabel's life has just gotten much better. A relative who lives in the cinder block house next door moves out. Maria Isabel and her family move in temporarily. They raise their old wood hut. Maria Isabel's brother begins to construct a cinder block home of their own. The relative's home isn't a vast improvement. The tin roof is held down with large rocks. A torn sheet offers privacy in the bathroom, which has no door. Occasionally, a mouse climbs up the gray walls. Still, it has two small bedrooms. Now, Maria Isabel shares a full-size bed with only her mother, sister, and Jasmin. In the hallway, which doubles as a living room and kitchen, Eva celebrates how far they've come. She proudly hangs 4 elementary school diplomas her children have earned, including Maria Isabel's. Maria Isabel's relationship with Enrique is coming unglued. Enrique used to send her money monthly, but in the year and a half since Maria Isabel has returned to live with her mother, Enrique has wired money only 4 times, usually between $150 and $180. Enrique is struggling financially. Fed up with the cramped conditions in his mother's apartment and their constant fights, yearning for some scrap of privacy, he has moved out and rented a bedroom in a trailer. Rent on his share of the trailer and utilities is $280. The payments on his used pickup truck and insurance run $580 a month, plus $200 in gas. His cell phone is $50 a month, and he gives his mother $200 a month for lunch and dinner, which he has at her house each night. Fixed costs eat up more than half of the $2,400 to $2,600 a month he makes. He's had to pay 2 police tickets. Sometimes, when work is slow, Lourdes has to loan him money for his truck payment. Maria Isabel knows none of this. She wonders if Enrique sends his daughter less money because he is spending it on another girlfriend. Enrique swears that there is no one else. Gloria warns Maria Isabel. I know you adore Enrique, but don't grow old waiting for him. If he doesn't send for you or return to Honduras soon, find someone else before you lose your looks. Maria Isabel has heard that Enrique drinks too much beer. It's hard to stay away from those drugs, she says. Before, when Enrique told her he was clean, she could ferret out the truth for herself. Now that he is far away, all she has is his word. Right after Enrique left, she felt desperate to be with him again. Over time, she has adapted to his absence. She has not dated anyone else, she says. When a neighbor in the brick house up the hill calls down that Enrique is on the line, Maria Isabel sprints over. Still, when she gets on the telephone, she cries less. She has matured, changed. Now her life revolves around her daughter. I love him, she says, but not like before. Equally troubling, Enrique calls less frequently. Since she moved into her mother's hut, Enrique has rung at the neighbor's house only 5 times. She feels snubbed. It feels as though the phone calls have become a one-way street. She stops calling Enrique as well. Both are stuck in their pride. He hasn't hired a smuggler because she hasn't asked for one. She hasn't said yes to coming because he hasn't hired a smuggler. They are drifting apart. She has tired of spending Sunday morning, her sole day off, downtown at the storefront internet store dialing Enrique. The manager types the number into one of the gray computers. $3 buys 15 minutes. Hello, my beautiful girl, he coos at Maria Isabel. Hello, how are you? He asks how Jasmine is. I love you. Do you have another boyfriend there, he asks. No, Maria Isabel answers. Enrique wishes she could be more affectionate on the telephone. Maria Isabel knows he wants her to say she loves him, but she can't. She has always been painfully shy. She feels inhibited in the internet store. When she first moved back into Ava's, Maria Isabel went to call Enrique every other week. Now they go 2 months without speaking. She brushes it off as a scheduling problem, or she rationalizes, I call him when he calls me. Enrique no longer talks of returning to Honduras. He tells her he likes the comforts of the United States. He hints that he wants her to come north soon. Yet the more attached Maria Isabel becomes to Jasmine, the more she resists leaving her. United States. After a few weeks, Miriam reaches the United States and settles in with Lourdes. She buys fake identification papers and quickly lands a restaurant job making biscuits. She nets $245 a week. She tells Lourdes that she will be there 3 years, no more. She doesn't buy any furniture. She won't let herself adjust to the comforts of life in the United States, such as hot water. She takes cold showers. She constantly reminds herself of the things she dislikes about the United States. Children live confined indoors. Diana spends her afternoons and evenings chatting with friends on the internet or watching television. In Honduras, Miriam's children play outside and come indoors only when they get hungry. U.S. immigration agents raid Walmarts around the country for illegal immigrants. Miriam frets about being deported. She doesn't like the way people from North Carolina look at her in public sometimes. As if she were inferior, different. On her days off, she stays in. In Honduras, each Sunday after church, Enrique's family takes Miriam's children to the airport, where they call their mother from a computer telephone. Study a lot, don't fight, be good to your grandma, Miriam tells them. Junior tells her he often feels like crying. He tells her he cannot sleep well at night. Quick-minded and chatty, he also tells Miriam about his excellent report card. Then he asks her to send him a bicycle. Miriam says she's sending Nike shoes and Spider-Man, Hulk, Batman, and Barbie dolls. I've bought beautiful things to send you. Mirjan's youngest is frightened when she hears her mother's voice on the telephone. For the first month, she pushes the telephone away. She hears her cousins call Mirjan auntie on the telephone. When she finally talks to her mother, she starts calling her mother auntie too. "I'm not your aunt, I'm your mother," Mirjan corrects her. "No, you're my auntie," the girl insists. Enrique shares the trailer with two Mexican couples. They have four young children. They are a constant reminder of Jasmin. Inside his bedroom, Enrique tapes two pictures of his daughter to his armoire mirror. One of her in a blue and white dress, another in a red and white dress. Two more framed pictures of her are on the shelf by his bed. He didn't like school. He worries. Will she be the same? Enrique loves sweets. Whenever he buys some, he thinks of buying candy for Jasmin. Nearly every day he sees things she might like. He tells himself he would buy them for her if she were there. He talks about her constantly to his friends. His happiest moments are when photographs arrive, or when Maria Isabel puts Jasmin on the line. "Te quiero, papi," Jasmin says. "I love you, Daddy." He knows Maria Isabel prompts Jasmin to say nice things to him. He doesn't care. In the end, she'll understand what's what. "I'm your daddy. Do you love your daddy?" Enrique asks. "Yes, I love you." She asks him to send things. "Papi, I want a piñata, one with candy inside." "I think she'll love me when she sees me," he tells himself. He pictures how their lives together will be. Everyone in Lourdes's house eats dinner at different hours, whenever they get home from work. His family will eat dinner together. Honduras. As Jasmin turns 3, she is inseparable from her mother. At night, they sleep in the same bed. In the morning, before she readies herself for work, Maria Isabel bathes her daughter with buckets of water and plaits her hair into two braids. When Maria Isabel heads off to work, Jasmin is in tears. "Mommy, mommy," she cries. Barefoot, she scrambles down the ravine after her mother. Her grandmother dashes after her and grabs her. "Ya vuelvo, I'll be right back," Maria Isabel calls up the hill as she walks away. At night, when Maria Isabel climbs back up the hill, Jasmin runs to her. She sits on her lap, her hands draped around her mother's neck. They rub noses. They play patty cake. Maria Isabel asks Jasmin to count to 10. With each number, she hoists her girl up in the air, then down. "Oh, you're getting so heavy!" Jasmin grabs her mother's hair, her ears. She squeals with delight. "What did you do today?" Maria Isabel asks. "Did you take a nap today?" In a sweet, squeaky voice, Jasmin answers each of her mother's questions. On Maria Isabel's day off, Jasmin is always at her side. Maria Isabel takes her daughter by the hand. They go downtown or to visit Gloria. She walks her down the sidewalk by Pizza Hut, crowded with carts piled with potatoes, plantains, and avocados. It is where Lourdes once sold gum and candy from a little box, with Enrique at her side. She carries Jasmin in her arms to the city's central plaza, where children beg with outstretched arms. She takes her into the cathedral, up to the gilded altar. She prays. She asks that Jasmin not get sick, that Enrique stay away from drugs. Then she takes Jasmin for a scoop of ice cream. Today, Sunday, she readies Jasmin for a friend's birthday party. She dresses her in a pink and white outfit and the gold hoop earrings, bracelet, and pendant of Jesus her father sent. As they walk across the heart of Tegucigalpa, Jasmin is a chatterbox. At the party, at the corrugated tin shack of Maria Isabel's cousin, Jasmin eats chicken, tries to blow up a red balloon, and borrows a pink bike with training wheels. But after a short while, she climbs into her mother's lap. Maria Isabel bounces on her knees. Jasmine strokes her mother's hair and whispers into her ear. Maria Isabel straightens Jasmine's braids. She rocks her in her arms. Jasmine kisses her mother lightly. Jasmine finds a bougainvillea branch blooming with red flowers and brings it to her mother. When it is Jasmine's turn to swat at the pink, dog-shaped piñata with a wooden stick, Maria Isabel cheers her on. Hit it hard, hard. She helps her get a piece of cake, then lines her up for her bag of party favors. She shows her how to blow a whistle, one of the gifts. At dusk, they take a bus home, Jasmine in Maria Isabel's arms. Lights twinkle on the hills of Tegucigalpa. Maria Isabel undresses Jasmine and slips on her white nightgown. Jasmine dumps her bag of party favors on the floor, eager to see what is inside. There are two butterfly hairpins. Maria Isabel puts them in Jasmine's hair. Jasmine dances to the music from the family's small television, twizzling her hips, her hands in the air. At 7:30 p.m., Maria Isabel climbs into bed with her daughter. Jasmine holds a bottle of milk with her left hand. With the right hand, she rubs her mother's belly. It is a ritual. She cannot fall asleep without stroking her mother's belly. Slowly, as she sucks on the milk, Jasmine loses her grip on the bottle. Her eyes flutter. Maria Isabel rolls her over and rubs Jasmine's back until the girl falls asleep. She can no longer imagine leaving her daughter. She has to tell Enrique. At most, she might leave Jasmine when she is old enough to understand what is happening. She would have to be at least 5 years old for me to leave her. Then at least I could try to explain it to her, Maria Isabel tells her family. Not a day before, she says firmly. It is the same age Enrique was when his mother left. Some of her friends tell her she would be a fool not to follow Enrique to the United States. She is young and can find work now, but women over the age of 25 or 28 are no longer considered for many jobs in Honduras. Something made clear in newspaper employment ads. One factory, S.J. Mariol, hires only women ages 18 to 25, says Lady Karina Lopez, head of human resources at the company. In the large brick building in Tegucigalpa, young women sit in rows behind sewing machines, furiously stitching medical scrubs for export to the United States. One woman sews a triangle at the bottom of the neck. She does it 2,520 times a day, 44 hours a week, for $110 a month. We look at the work, and it requires a lot of energy and dedication. At 30, they might have back problems or eye problems or arthritis. We want to avoid that, Lopez says. Without high productivity, she says, the work will move to lower-wage countries such as China. The children's store Maria Isabel works at won't hire women older than 23. Middle-aged women have three options, says Argentina Norma Valeriano, Maria Isabel's neighbor. Washing and ironing clothes, cleaning houses, or making tortillas at home. Jobs that pay $50 to $90 a month. A family needs $350 a month minimum, says a social worker, Francis Jeanette Gomez Irias, with the Instituto Hondureño de la Niñez y la Familia. In 1998, Hurricane Mitch caused many Honduran businesses to go under. Unemployment and sub-unemployment combined now affect 43% of Hondurans. Government jobs go to people in certain families or with good connections, says Norma. Most of Maria Isabel's neighbors, including 25 on her block, have no work, she adds. They survive only because someone in the family has gone north and sends back money. The children of single mothers suffer most, she says. Maria Isabel wouldn't be the first in her family to go to the United States and leave children behind. Her aunt, Eva's sister Tina, left four children in Honduras to go to Los Angeles in the early 1980s. Maria Isabel's eldest sister, Olga, went to Houston in 1990. She left Jose, 1.5 years old, and Denis, Alexander, 3, with her mother, Eva. For 8 years, Olga sent Eva $50 or $100 a month to help her raise the boys. In 1998, Eva's other sister, Laura, left 2 children behind. Eventually, the 3 women were able to bring their children to the United States, some legally, others with smugglers. When Maria Isabel sees couples walking down the street with their children, it saddens her. If she went to the United States, would it allow Jasmine to have both her parents at her side more quickly? Jasmine, she knows, needs her father. Jasmine has taken to calling the only man in Eva's house, her 27-year-old uncle, Miguel, Papi. With Enrique, Jasmine has to be coached to talk. With Miguel, words of affection come naturally. One evening, Jasmine returns from a friend's birthday party. She runs to Miguel with a bag full of candy, a party treat. Papi, Jasmine says, handing him pieces of the candy. Papi tenga, here, Daddy. She doesn't normally share her candy. With Miguel, she is generous. She gives him a full report of the day. How she hit the piñata, ate rice and cake, drank soda, how people took pictures. Jasmine runs and flops on his bed. Miguel chases her, tickling her ribs. Many afternoons, when Maria Isabel is away at work, Jasmine eludes her grandmother and wanders next door, where Miguel is constructing the family's new house. She climbs the ladder to the 2nd floor. There she serves as Miguel's little assistant. As he lays floor tiles, Miguel points to the sponge. Jasmine brings it. He points to a flat spatula. She brings that too. Pass me the hammer, he says in his gentle voice. When Miguel heads down the hill at dusk to play soccer, he says, Me voy, Jasmine. I'm off, Jasmine. She quickly answers, Vamos, papi. Let's go, daddy. Enrique senses that his daughter has begun to identify someone else as her father. Late in the year, as Christmas approaches, he promises her he'll come visit. Maria Isabel sees even more reasons to stay in Honduras with her daughter. A year-long government advertising campaign has highlighted the dangers of the journey. Newspapers carry a stream of accounts of people injured or killed during the trek north. Maria Isabel's sister, Irma, tried to make it to the United States but ran out of money in Mexico and had to turn back. So did one of her brothers. Maria Isabel asks one of her sisters about her trip. She tells her she was often hungry. Maria Isabel asks if she was raped. The sister doesn't answer. What if she doesn't make it? What would become of her daughter? She'd have to live illegally in the United States, always fearful of being caught and deported. There is racism. She would be treated as inferior. Her mother emphasizes that the United States is a cold place, where neighbors barely know one another. She doesn't want to miss all the important moments in Jasmine's life. She thinks about everything Enrique has already missed. Soon Jasmine will attend her first day of kindergarten. Maria Isabel has heard how mothers who leave lose the love of their children. Rosa Amalia, who raised Enrique's sister Belki, has seen the effects of these separations. She advises Maria Isabel to wait until Jasmine is older, when Enrique might be able to bring them both together. Maria Isabel devises a plan to stay. If she doesn't have any more children and she works hard, she can give her daughter a shot at a good education. It's not impossible. With one child, I can give her what she wants, Maria Isabel says. I'm not leaving without Jasmine, she tells Gloria. Belki has secretly been seeing a new boyfriend, Giovanni. Eventually, Giovanni goes to Rosa Amalia, who has raised Belki, to pedir la llegada, ask for permission to date. Rosa Amalia agrees after Giovanni vows chastity. Rosa Amalia wants Belki to stop living in limbo, always fixating on reunifying with her mother. She hopes she will finish her studies in business administration and eventually form her own family in Honduras. Belki begins to think that if she doesn't see her mother soon, she will never see her. I just want to give her a hug. A bunch of hugs. I just want to be by her side, even if it's for a short while, she says. One night, Giovanni proposes as they sit outside her cinderblock hut. Giovanni is not handsome. He lives with his mother, a tamale maker, in a tiny wooden shack. But he is kind, drinks rarely, and buys her little presents. He treats her like a queen. She loves him. Belki asks Lourdes to provide a few $1,000s to build a tiny house on land beside her grandmother's home, land reserved for the house Lourdes was to build upon her return. When she marries, her mother won't be there. Her aunt and uncle will walk her down the aisle. United States. Lourdes works on a cleaning crew, then on a factory assembly line. It is hard living with so many people jammed into her apartment, especially because the men don't help. When she arrives home, the kitchen trash is full, the floors are dirty, and she must cook and clean for everyone. Although the men come home at different hours, Lourdes waits up to serve each of them dinner. On her day off, she takes the men's laundry, 6 baskets, to the laundromat. On Sunday, she buys $300 in groceries, enough to last the clan a week. Having 7 people split the cost of the 3-bedroom apartment, which costs $800 a month, allows Lourdes to send money back to her daughter and mother in Honduras. To Lourdes, it seems as though every relative in Honduras who has money troubles thinks they can ask her for help. One night, Enrique and a friend start talking about gangs in Honduras. Lourdes says that Honduras is a horrible, lawless place. Enrique chafes at such talk, especially from Lourdes. It is your country, he says. Mom, I don't know why you hate your country so much. I'll never go back, she says. The discussion devolves into another big fight. For the 3rd time since he arrived, Enrique accuses Lourdes of abandoning him in Honduras. He tells her his true mother is his grandmother Maria. Enrique has hung a picture of the Last Supper above the headboard of his bed. It reminds him of her. His grandmother had several pictures of the Last Supper hanging in her hut. He misses the beans and spaghetti she made for him. He misses going to church with her as a child. Lourdes believes that Enrique's comments reveal a fear. If he goes back to Central America, his mother will not follow him. They will once again live apart. Lourdes's boyfriend tries to find a way to alleviate the sadness he sees in Lourdes. Mira, honey, he says, tome la distancia. Look, honey, put some distance between you. It's no use arguing and fighting with Enrique, he tells her. It's a fight you will not win. You're both equally stubborn. Neither of you likes to be contradicted or told he is wrong. You have to control your anger when Enrique baits you. If Enrique does something she doesn't like, Lourdes ignores it. She still cooks his dinner, but no longer serves him his plate of food. She stops doing his laundry. They no longer routinely go out to dinner on Saturday night, or grocery shopping on Sunday. With the new year, Lourdes, her boyfriend, and their relatives decide to leave North Carolina. The paint firm where most of the men work is in financial trouble and has cut back on everyone's hours. Jobs are scarce. They move to Florida, where a cousin of Lourdes's boyfriend gets everyone painting jobs. Lourdes and her sister Miriam start as hotel maids for $6.50 an hour. Each cleans 16 to 18 rooms per shift. 8 people cram into a small 2-bedroom apartment. Enrique sleeps on the living room sofa. He hates it. He misses his friends in North Carolina. He has to get up before dawn to be painting by 6:30 a.m. Lourdes's sister, Marianne, toys with the idea of bringing her children to the United States, but quickly dismisses it as too dangerous. She switches to a job washing dishes for $9 an hour. She focuses on saving enough to return to her children in what she hopes will be another 2 years. She needs to save $10,000 to $15,000 to add a beauty salon to her mother's house and send her 3 children to school. So far, she has banked $1,200. Enrique constantly nags Miriam to go back. "Why are you going to abandon your kids?" he asks her. After fights with his mother, Enrique always has a warning for his aunt, Miriam. "This will happen to you because you left your children when they were young. You think that filling our bellies is the same thing as love." As Enrique mulls over returning to North Carolina, he becomes more loving with his mother. He hugs and kisses her often. Finally, he decides to go. Lourdes begs him to stay. She tells him she will not follow him back to North Carolina. She has a life now in Florida with her de facto husband, daughter, and sister. "You've never acknowledged me as a real mother. I have to work at my life with my husband now," she tells Enrique. Enrique quietly packs and leaves. Lourdes wants to enjoy her life more and worry about Enrique less. She and her boyfriend go out Saturday nights to a buffet dinner. Lourdes relishes moments with her daughter Diana. She teases Diana when she flubs a phrase in Spanish. Diana helps teach her mother English in a southern drawl. Lourdes and her boyfriend can finally afford their own apartment. She'd like to open a paint store with him someday, maybe buy a double-wide trailer. Mostly she prays for an amnesty for immigrants so she can become legal and bring her daughter Belki to the United States. "God, give me my papers. I want to be with my daughter," she says. "I ask God to give me this before I die." She begins to sob. "Is that so much to ask of God? I don't ask God for riches or other things." In North Carolina, Enrique focuses on working, on saving money, on cutting down even more on drinking and drugs. He'll need $5,000 for a smuggler to bring his girlfriend north. Enrique gently tries to convince Maria Isabel to commit to the move. "Maria Isabel, you know I am very good to you. I give you everything," he tells her on the telephone. He loves her. He misses her serene, calm nature. How much she would cry and giggle. How simple she is. He misses walking her home from school, holding her hand. If they live apart too long, Enrique fears, Maria Isabel will find someone else. "If you find someone who loves you as much as I do, go with him," Enrique says. "I left you. I understand." In truth, he desperately wants to hear her protest such talk, to know if she is interested in anyone else. She tells him she loves him for life. Why doesn't she tell him she wants to come be with him? He is reaching his breaking point. He resolves to call her and ask point blank, "Are you coming or not?" He knows Maria Isabel has been stalling, that she is anxious about leaving Jasmin. He's been stalling too. He wants to learn English and get his vices totally under control before bringing her to the United States. Yet the sooner Maria Isabel comes, the easier it will be for both of them to save money and return to Honduras. The sooner he will see his daughter. He is resolved to be with her by the time she is 5, 6 at the latest. If not, Jasmin won't embrace him as her father. "She'll see me as a stranger," he says. He'll go back to Honduras when she is 6, even if it is for a brief visit, and he has to make his way back through Mexico illegally again. "I need to see her, to be with her." As time passes, Enrique sees other things with equal clarity. He knows now that his mother will never offer an apology for leaving him. He tries to put the love he has always felt for Lourdes above the resentment he has harbored all these years. He gives his mother his first gift. $100 for her birthday. She uses it to buy a dress and a bottle of lotion. Enrique and Lourdes start to call each other 2 or 3 times a week to talk. Enrique has long called his mother Señora. Now he says Ma. With each call, he is more loving. Tan bonita mi mami. La quiero mucho. My beautiful mother, I love you so much, he says. Lourdes teases. Mentiroso viejo. You old liar. He even begins to make plans to move from North Carolina to Florida. He does not want to live apart from his mother anymore. Lourdes is sure that God is answering one of her prayers. That Enrique straighten up, stop drinking, and no longer feel so bitter toward her. It's like a miracle, she says. It is as if all the hurt he felt inside had to come out, and now he is ready to move on. She feels the same warmth and love from Enrique as when he first arrived on her doorstep in North Carolina. He always wanted to be with me, she says. The Girl Left Behind. It is spring 2004. Enrique has been gone for 4 years. Enrique and Maria Isabel have not spoken for more than 4 months, since last Christmas. Enrique calls his sister Belki. Go find Maria Isabel, he tells her. Tell her she must call me. Maria Isabel dials from the internet store. Why don't you call me? He asks. She answers curtly that she doesn't have anything to talk about. Are you ready to come? He asks. Maria Isabel tells herself he is joking. When he was sniffing glue in Honduras, he often said things he didn't really mean. Even if he's serious, she can't leave until Jasmine is at least 5 years old. She promised. You must make a decision, Enrique says, now. If not, he vows, he will remake his life, find someone else. I don't want to leave, she tells him. Enrique cajoles. I've changed, he tells her. I drink, but just a little now. I don't use glue. I'm not the same person. She doesn't budge. If you come, he tells her, it will be the best thing for Jasmine. Together we'll provide her a better life. We'll both be able to return to her sooner. Now she is listening. I'll think about it, she says. Her answer fills Enrique with hope. He starts calling Maria Isabel constantly. I need you, he says. You're the mother of my child. You're the only one I want to marry. Day and night, Maria Isabel turns it over in her mind. If she stays and marries, her husband would never treat Jasmine as if she were his own. Maria Isabel decides. In the long run, leaving will help Jasmine. Eventually, she will be with her real mother and father. Everyone together. She strikes a deal with Enrique. Jasmine will live with Belki, but spend weekends with her mother. I will do it for my daughter, she says. A few days later, word reaches Maria Isabel from a smuggler. He will call next week, probably on Tuesday or Wednesday. She must be ready. Maria Isabel hauls all of Jasmine's clothing and dolls over to the cinder block hut, where Belki lives behind her grandmother's home. She waits next door at Gloria's for the smuggler to call Rosa Amalia, who has just gotten hooked up to phone service. She hugs her daughter over and over. She cries and cries. Jasmine asks, Why are you crying so much, Mommy? Maria Isabel tells Jasmine her arm hurts. She tells her a cavity in her mouth aches. Don't cry, Mommy, Jasmine says. Saddened by her mother's tears, Jasmine cries too. Why are you crying? Rosa Amalia asks the girl. Because my mommy is crying. My mommy cries all the time. Maria Isabel hasn't told her daughter she is leaving. She can't. Still, Jasmine is bright. A neighbor asks Maria Isabel, Are you leaving already? Hasmin asks, "Where is my mother going?" She asks her mother why she has moved all her clothes from her grandmother Eva's to Belki's hut across town. "Why," she asks her mother, "has Maria Isabel packed a white backpack with her own clothes?" "I'm going out," Maria Isabel says. "I'll be right back." "Where are you going?" "I'm going downtown." "Are you coming back?" "Yes." Hasmin believes her. And this time she does come back. Sometimes when Hasmin asks if her mother is coming back, Maria Isabel is silent. She does not answer. She doesn't like lying to Hasmin. But Maria Isabel is sure her daughter is too young, at 3 1/2, to understand the truth. She can't handle a scene, demands by Hasmin to take her with her. She doesn't want to see her daughter cry. "This is easier, better," Maria Isabel tells herself. Wednesday. The smuggler calls at 1 p.m. Maria Isabel must be across town at Tegucigalpa's main bus station at 3:30 p.m. The smuggler says he will be wearing a red shirt and blue jeans. What will Maria Isabel have on? "A black blouse and blue jeans," Enrique's family tells him. Maria Isabel heads back to Belki's hut with Hasmin. She holds her in her arms and gives her a last bottle of milk. Maria Isabel heads over to Enrique's grandmother's. "I'm leaving now. Goodbye," she says. "God bless you," the grandmother says. "The family will pray for her during her journey north," she tells her. Next door at Gloria's, Maria Isabel hugs her mother and sister. Enrique's aunt Rosa Amalia takes Hasmin back to Belki's hut, hoping to prevent a scene. Hasmin will have none of it. She's overheard some of the goodbyes. That Rosa Amalia is driving Maria Isabel to the bus terminal. "I'm coming. I'm coming to drop off my mother," she tells Rosa Amalia, who relents. Hasmin runs to the car and gets in. Maria Isabel takes the backpack, which contains a change of clothes and one picture of her daughter. Belki and her boyfriend climb in, too. At the bus terminal, Rosa Amalia won't let Hasmin get out of the car. Only passengers are allowed beyond the waiting room. Maria Isabel is relieved. She tells herself that it is all right, that Hasmin doesn't really understand what is happening. Maria Isabel does not say goodbye to her daughter. She does not hug her. She gets out of the car and walks briskly into the bus terminal. She does not look back. She never tells her she is going to the United States. Rosa Amalia lifts Hasmin onto the hood of her car. As the bus pulls out of the terminal, she tells the girl to say goodbye. Hasmin waves with both hands and calls out, "Adios, mommy! Adios, mommy! Adios, mommy! Adios, mommy!" Afterward. Women, children, and the immigration debate. An estimated 1.7 million children live illegally in the United States, most from Mexico and Central America. Like Enrique, almost all have spent time away from a parent before following him or her to the United States. One in four children in the nation's schools is an immigrant or the child of an immigrant. A group whose numbers between 1990 and 2000 grew seven times faster than that of children with both parents born in the United States. Children leaving Central America to find their mothers in the United States now face a tougher, more treacherous journey than ever before. Anti-gang crackdowns in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala have pushed many gangsters north into Chiapas, where they prey on migrants aboard the trains. Gangsters who once used border cities in Guatemala as their homes have moved their bases into Chiapas. Freight trains pull into the station in Tonalá, in northern Chiapas, with dead migrants atop the boxcars. In 2004, fed up with rampant violence, more than 5,000 Tapachula residents marched in the streets, demanding that Mexico establish a death penalty for gangsters. Since Enrique's journey, the number of police agencies targeting migrants in Chiapas has grown from 5 to 8. To elude the additional officers, migrants take ever greater risks to get on and off moving trains. The result: the number of migrants arriving at Tapachula's General Hospital with train injuries has more than doubled. The train is no longer stopped by La Migra at La Arrocera, the checkpoint where migrants had to outrun bandits lying in wait. In 2003, when La Arrocera became too dangerous even for Migra agents, the train stop was moved to Los Toros, Chiapas. There, reinforced by 3 other police agencies and the army, 60 to 80 officers swarm the train, using ladders to reach atop the cars, catching 4 of 5 migrants. Just south of the checkpoint in Tres Hermanos, a new crop of bandits has emerged. Migrants who try to avoid the authorities by walking the tracks are robbed, injured, and even killed by local thugs. To the north, in Nuevo Laredo along the Rio Grande, where Enrique camped, a battle for control of the border rages among rival Mexican drug cartels. The body of El Torindaro, the smuggler who crossed Enrique into Texas, was found in February 2002 near the road to the Nuevo Laredo airport. He had been blindfolded, tortured, and shot in the head, execution style. El Torindaro, identified as Diego Cruz Ponce, was one of 57 murders in Nuevo Laredo that year, and the violence has escalated since then. In 2005, the new police chief, who vowed to bring law and order to the city, was gunned down hours after taking office. Across the length of Mexico, people who help migrants are troubled to see more pregnant women and parents with young children aboard freight trains. Some parents are carrying babies in their arms. Despite the increased danger, more migrants are making the attempt. Between 2001 and 2004, the number of Central American migrants detained and deported each year by Mexico nearly doubled, to more than 200,000. Most come from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, and are trying to reach the United States. In Tapachula alone, up to 17 buses full of detained migrants are sent south each day. Some of the buses are designated just for children who have been traveling alone through Chiapas. During the same period, the number of Central American children detained by the U.S. Border Patrol while entering the country illegally and without either parent nearly doubled. Throughout Latin America, even in traditional societies such as Mexico, where most legal and illegal migrants to the United States come from, divorce and separation are increasingly common. That promises to produce more single mothers who feel forced to make the same choice Lourdes made long ago: leave their children and head north. The growing influx of women and children will fuel questions already raging about immigration. Is it good for the migrants themselves, for the countries they come from, and for the United States and its citizens? For immigrants, the material benefits of coming to the United States are clear. The money Lourdes sent Enrique allowed him to eat and dress better and attend school longer. Once he arrived in the United States, Enrique drove his own truck and could make a decent living if he worked hard. Enrique loves how clean the streets are compared to those in Honduras, how most people respect and obey the laws. His aunt Marianne notes that the United States is less class-driven than Honduras. Here, people don't look down on her if she dresses humbly. Lourdes enjoys taking showers with indoor plumbing, as well as the relative safety of her neighborhood, where she can wear a gold necklace without worry. She has the freedom to get in her car and go anywhere she wants. Enrique acknowledges drawbacks. He must live in the shadows, knowing he can be deported at any time. He faces racism. When he goes into a restaurant and can't order well in English, he gets dirty stares. "They look at you as if you are a flea," he says. Salespeople in stores often attend to Anglo customers first. Even Mexicans look down on Central Americans, whom many view as inferior. Enrique's aunt Marianne says her restaurant employers pay her less than they pay her Anglo colleagues, and assign immigrants the hardest tasks. Life in America, Enrique and others say, is too hurried. In Honduras, people work half a day Saturday and rest Sunday. Here, Enrique paints 7 days a week, in an endless struggle to pay bills. Here, he says, life is a race. For most immigrants who come to the United States, the biggest downside is the toll parent-child separations exact on families. The family conflicts are most visible in the nation's schools, where teachers and administrators from New York to Los Angeles struggle daily to mend the damage caused by the years apart for parents and children. Newcomer traumas. Life inside Los Angeles's newcomer school, a transitional school for newly arrived immigrant students, shows both how common and devastating these separations are for the immigrants themselves. Each day, the school's soft-spoken counselor, Gabriel Murillo, finds the small wooden box outside his office full of requests to see the counselor slips. More than half of the 430 high school students will ask to see him by year's end. The reason? Problemas familiares, they write. Family problems. Most have recently reunited with a parent, usually a mother. On average, they have not seen the parent in a decade. Hour after hour, parent-child meetings play out with a scary similarity, Murillo says. Idealized notions each had of the other quickly shatter. Some children felt resentful before coming north. Others have deeply buried anger that emerges after months with their mothers. Inside Murillo's office, children usually fire the first salvo. "I know you don't love me, that's why you left me there." Some mothers, to avoid traumatic farewells, told their children they were going out to the market or to see their children's teachers, and instead left for the United States. The children say their mothers lied to them from the start. They prayed their mothers would get caught by the U.S. Border Patrol and sent back. They demand that their mothers admit their mistakes and apologize for leaving them. Mothers endured pain leaving their children and struggled to work hard and send back money, and they demand respect for their sacrifice. They are certain the separations were worth what was gained. But their children say they would have preferred being together, even if it meant going hungry. "I didn't want money, I wanted you there." They tell their mothers they would never leave their own children. They tell them they are worse than animals. Even an animal doesn't desert her litter. Murillo fights what is usually a losing battle. It's a huge emotional scar. For some, the damage continues for the rest of their lives. "It is irreparable," he says. "Some eventually improve their relationships with their mothers, but it takes years." Mothers expect to finally have the perfect family when their children arrive. Instead, they face rejection and constant fights. Eventually, they realize the choice they made may have cost them the love of their children. Children who thought they would find love and an end to loneliness discover that they feel more distant than ever from their mothers, even though they are now with them. Some children are resentful because they were abused or neglected by their caretakers or bullied by others back home. 1 in 20 girls at the school admits to being molested by a male relative. They blame their mothers for not being there to protect them. Others are angry because they had to leave behind a grandmother who became the person who loved and nurtured them most, a real mother. They worry that their departure means the loss of the grandparents' only source of income. They know they may never see their grandparents again. Actions by both mothers and children make matters worse. Children act out, doing everything possible to push their mothers away. It is their way of testing whether their mothers really love them, whether they can trust them, whether their mothers will abandon them again. Mothers, beset by guilt, don't discipline their children or set rules. To pay off their debts to the smugglers, they often work overtime, and after so much time apart, children feel their mothers are ignoring them again. Some mothers continue to work as live-in nannies or housekeepers after their children arrive. They place their children in an apartment with relatives or friends, calling at night, visiting on weekends. The conflicts Murillo sees are most acute when the child was the last to be brought north, because the mother couldn't afford to bring everyone at once. Such children come to believe that the mother favored the children she brought north first. The clashes are also severe when the mother has a new husband or has given birth to additional children in the United States. Some mothers, fearful of how children left behind would react, have hidden these new families from them. Newly arrived children try to create conflicts between their mothers and the new husbands, hoping to drum them out. Children born in the United States, jealous that their mothers are showering the newcomers with attention, tell lies about the new children, hoping to get them in trouble and shipped back. Some mothers, Murillo says, do many things right. They leave children with relatives who constantly emphasize that the parents left to help their children. They keep in constant contact during the separation. They are open and honest about their lives in the United States. They never promise anything, especially a visit or reunion, until they are positive they can deliver. Even in these cases, Murillo says, the reunions are rocky. He has dealt with students who tried to stab their mothers, who asked to have guardianship transferred to someone else, who turned suicidal. One mother says, "I think it's like the Bible says, people will move around, but not find peace." Many reunified children, not finding the love they had hoped for with their mothers, search for love elsewhere, Murillo says. Some boys find a family in the local gangs and end up selling drugs. A girl might find unconditional love by getting pregnant, having a baby, and moving in with the father. Gangs and pregnancy are much more common among reunited children than among those born here, says Zenaida Gabriel, a case manager at Sunrise Community Counseling Center, where some newcomer students go for help. Newcomer school psychologist Laura Lopez estimates that only 70 of 430 students will complete high school. Indeed, immigration expert Jeffrey Passell says nearly half of all Central American children who arrive in the United States after the age of 10 don't graduate from high school. A Harvard University study found that immigrant children in U.S. schools who spent time separated from parents are often depressed, act up, have trouble trusting anyone, and don't respond to the authority of parents they weren't raised with. Los Angeles Unified School District psychologist Bradley Pilon believes only 1 in 10 immigrant students ultimately accepts his or her parent and puts the rancor he or she feels toward the parent in perspective. Murillo's conclusion, the parents say, "I had to do it." But that's not enough for these children. All of them feel the resentment. Special education teacher Marga Rodriguez adds, "This isn't worth it. In the end, you lose your kids." But she admits she doesn't know what it's like not to have anything to feed your hungry children. Oscar Escalada Hernandez, director of the Casa YMCA shelter for immigrant children in Tijuana, Mexico, agrees. "In the end, it is a mess," he says. The effect of immigration has been family disintegration. People are leaving behind the most important value, family unity. The survivors, like Enrique, try to block out problems with